Thank you so much for coming out here with me, Christopher. I'm having a wonderful time. You mean a lot to me, and I'm glad that you're having a blast.
On Tuesday, which would have been the 14th of August, you had read some newspaper articles on the 13th and the 14th that regarded this case. You had also had a conversation with Chris at some point during the day on Monday. And on Tuesday, because of what you found, specifically what you said was, and don't let me put words in your mouth, but you found out that his wife was pregnant.
Yes.
And you did not know that prior?
No.
And you found that out via the newspaper articles, and that caused you concern.
I just realized that he was lying to me, and I was like, well, if you can lie to me about this, what else are you lying to me about? And it made me realize that maybe his wife was in danger at that point, and it was day two, too, and she still wasn't home.
What did that cause you to do with your phone, though?
Oh, what, when I deleted those? I was just kind of grossed out by him, to be honest with you. I was just like, I don't know what's going on right now, but you just lied to me, and I don't want to see this come over my phone anymore. So I removed it.
So you you already said, but you removed text messages?
I deleted all of his stuff because he lied to me. I mean, that's what it was. It was the hurt that made me delete it, and then it was the lie that made me start questioning everything else he'd been telling me for the last few days.
And that's when you decided to come forward?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavior analyst, former New Scotland Yard, author of the Domestic Abuse, Stalking, and Harassment and Honor-Based Violence Risk Model, and author of the book Policing Domestic Violence.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and we're diving right back into our discussion of the 2018 murders of Shannon Watts and her children, Bella, Celeste, and Nico, at the hands of Chris Watts. And Jim and Laura, this is one of those cases people cannot let go of. It has wrapped itself around, you know, it wraps itself around your head and your heart. And even though the murder eventually confessed and was convicted and is serving multiple life sentences, the interest in this case has never waned, and it's been reinvigorated by the Netflix amazing documentary American Murder, The Family Next Door, directed by Jenny Popplewell.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why is it's such a shocking set of events. I mean, when you literally annihilate your whole family and just sweet, innocent children, as well as a loving, caring wife who actually cared about the murderer, actually loved him, actually wanted to set whatever was wrong right. And just the cold, calculated nature of that is just, I think it just blows people away.
I would agree with that. I think this is a case that people feel the why done it. You know, why did he do it? There have been so many reasons that he has given, in fact, at least three reasons. And I think it's also a case that, yes, family wipeouts are relatively rare. But what I will say is that when they do happen, we tend to have two. One happens, then the media report on it, and then another one happens as if it gives somebody an idea. And there's research going back 20 years that's shown that. And it's something certainly that I've looked at. So is it something that somebody gets an idea of a way out when they feel, let's say, they've got black and white thinking in their backs against the wall? But I also want to say that we had a horrific family wipeout in England, Kelly Fitzgibbons and her children, and across the period of COVID lockdown. And the media just basically put that it was a COVID-related murder. And so oftentimes these cases get masked. And there are far more than what most people would think. But when they do happen, I think people, and we talked about the Hannah Clark case in Australia. Do you remember in February, Hannah Clark and her three children, Alia, Leana, and Trey, were in a car, and Rowan Baxter poured petrol into the car and set them all on fire. Absolutely horrific.
Unbelievable.
Really horrific. And yet again, the media talked about memorializing him, father found with three children, didn't even mention the mother. And so people don't really understand what these cases are about. And again, everyone looked to what drove him to this, in inverted commas. And it's that kind of narrative that I think when we're doing this series, we really need to set straight. And when people are searching, even the comments, as you've seen, Lisa, on our Facebook account and our other social media platforms, people keep talking about what Shanann did or didn't do, what Nikki did or didn't do, as if the answer lies with them. And that's the narrative that I get so pissed off with, as if male violence, the reason why we have male violence is because of something a woman did or didn't do. And that is getting very old, very wearing. And it's women and men, by the way, who fall into that trap. It's not just about men saying those sorts of things. So I know with Nikki, people did write on our Facebook page and on Instagram, oh, she's the mastermind behind all of this. So perhaps we should jump in and talk about that first of all. And one thing for me to say was that when we did an episode a few ago, I said that clearly on interview, she didn't really know anything about what was going on. Well, I just want to stand corrected on that, because I have read emails now in exchange between Chris Watts and Nikki in June when they're first introduced. And it's clear she does know about Shanann. She does know about the children. And therefore, you know, she does talk about him having this perfect family life. So she obviously did know about Shanann and the children. And there were clearly points where she lied. But my experience is when people lie on questioning, certainly by the police in the wake of something as catastrophic as this, we all have secrets to hide. And normally it's because they don't want a secret to be revealed.
Right.
They feel shameful about
it. Exactly.
It's not to say they're complicit within a murder or they're the mastermind behind it. So what do you think about that, Jim?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things we teach when we're talking about deception. And it, yes, you can detect deception, especially when there's something that directly contradicts the statement that's made. But when we find that, even in murder investigation, the most common thing that is lied about is covering up an affair, not the murder itself. So once somebody lies to you about something, you still have to drill down and find out why they're lying and what they're lying about. And in this case, there's absolutely no indication that there was any kind of pre-planning that she was any part of. And clearly, she knew about his wife and kids. But was he telling her that it was over? Was that why he was acting so distant from Shanann? Was that why he didn't at all show any interest in his children during the time that they were away at his parents and her parents? I mean, those are things that show, like you said, Laura, you know, this sort of black and white thinking, this sort of very surface way of existing, and it's either yes or no, it's all or nothing. He didn't have the sophistication to adequately hide his philandering. It was very obvious to Shanann that something was going on. And so she wanted to directly address it, and she wanted to communicate about it, and she wanted to fix it. But he had no interest in that. So he may never have told Nicole what the truth was, that Shanann had no idea he was out with her, had no idea that this relationship was anything like over. I mean, Shanann thought it was just going on as usual. Maybe they hit a bump in the road, and she would do everything she could to fix it. So to say Nicole was at all involved in deciding that there would be a family annihilation here, it's absurd. There isn't a shred of evidence to support that.
I think people are thrown off because there are odd things about maybe she did internet searches on them before the affair, and some of her texts can be easily twisted if you don't know the tone. After Shanann went missing, she texted Chris, let her fucking go, and why don't you just sell the wedding ring? In the context of their conversation, you know, you can explain why she was saying that.
Yeah, well, she would say that only if she knew nothing about her disappearance. He's telling Nicole, obviously, that Shanann took off with the kids, which, you know, is probably what he told her that he wanted to happen. So for her to say, yeah, let her go, it's clear that she had no idea that he had murdered them.
And the fact he's just texting afterwards, like a normal everyday life, you know, after he has disposed of all three bodies, that says a lot about Chris Watts. And we will get into the psychology. But yes, you're right, Jim. She was helping him find an apartment. So she had said she did know that they were separating or separated, you know, in inverted commas. He did talk about the children as well. So it's clear that he had factored them in to them, you know, him separating and the children still playing a part in their lives. He didn't lie about the children existing or anything about them. So I think that, again, is significant. And we have to place this relationship in the context. It's less than 2 months, right? They meet in June. They're working together, but apparently they don't meet properly until June. So we've only really got a couple of months in the relationship. And I do just want to say something about the word mistress that I keep seeing bandied around that makes me cringe and want to burn the house down. You know, this is not a mistress. And we have this awful misogyny bullshit that always goes on, you know, the scarlet woman, the woman who, you know, is the mistress, and as if she's the one responsible for this behavior.
She's responsible for it.
She's not married, right? He is. Right. He's the one that is unloyal.
He's the cheater. He's the one destroying this family. He's the one that takes all the blame.
Yeah, so I think people need to, you know, we always say on Real Crime Profile, language matters, and we try and improve our language all the time. But there are these words that are just so loaded against women. And I do think that that also plays into why we keep focusing on the women as if they explain male violence. So I think, you know, with Nikki Kessinger, she made some bad decisions for sure. And according to Chris Watts, there were so many different reasons for why he did it. One of the last ones that I've heard more recently is because, well, if he had never have met Nikki, then he would never have done this. And again, people listen to that and it sets the context of, look at Nikki, it's her fault. She got in the way of this relationship. But this was Chris Watts's decision making and Chris Watts' decision making alone. And I think that is obvious after he just coolly and clinically and carefully disposes of the bodies with a psychological mindset of no bodies, no crime. And then he just continues as normal. And that's his way of dealing with it. And his communication with Nikki, to me, is clear. Post-offense behavior, when he's unenrolling the children from school, when he's trying to put the house on the market, when he's not the one that reports them missing, it's her best friend, Nicole, who is a complete shiro in all of this, and it must be absolutely devastating at the time for her, but even now the resurgence of all of this, of everyone picking through it all again, I'm sure is not easy.
The last thing I just want to mention, Laura, you know, to disabuse people of this, Nicole was the Lady Macbeth to Chris's Macbeth to, you know, kill everybody. It seems that she was very encouraging that the children were not in her way whatsoever. She was looking forward to meeting them and helping them paint pottery and plant plants. And, you know, she was telling Chris that her parents got divorced around the same age and she had a sister, and it worked out well because the parents were happy being apart. I mean, I think a lot of people are saying that she was whispering in his ear and trying to help him plan this annihilation. And
there is no indication at all that he planned this at all. It was so poorly done. He had to had to react in order to pull it off, and to not even think to have his children be somewhere else when it happened tells me that it's something that he decided to do in the moment, not something that he spent a tremendous amount of time planning for. I mean, I believe things came to a head and he acted and killed Shanann and then had to sort of scramble and figure out what to do. I mean, to load his two daughters into the back of a pickup truck with their dead mother on the floor. I mean, just talk about just complete and total lack of planning. I don't believe he did plan in advance. I don't believe Nicole, Nikki had anything to do with it. And I know that as a result of his poor planning, he was caught within hours.
Well, I certainly don't believe Nikki had anything to do with it. I think that's what we can certainly put to bed. But I do think the events leading up to this family wipeout are very interesting because we do see significant behavioral change on his behalf. And I think that's what we need to unpick. It's not necessarily just the murder event itself, although Jim and Lisa, there are questions about that morning. And as I mentioned before, the timeline, 1:48 a.m. is when Shanann gets back. And then we know that he's loading the truck at 5:17 in the morning. So we have a very small window of time, effectively.
Right.
And this, to me, is really the tipping point. But it's all the events leading up that get us to this point that I think are also significant in the fact that even if we take that weekend where Shanann's away, she's gone away on a work trip. Well, she's on that work trip, but we know from Nicole, from her best friend, she wasn't eating, she wasn't sleeping. She was really, you know, very upset and very distressed about what was going on in the relationship. And we know that she saw the statement from the lazy dog, the $63 of dinner that he has bought. And that probably led her to the conclusion that she was right in her gut reaction that he was cheating on her. And so when you have that confirmed, and I just want our listeners, and obviously Jim and Lisa, we put ourselves at times into someone's shoes to try and understand behavior and what was going on, although our own experience doesn't necessarily, we won't all have the same reaction. But if you were, now it was confirmed to you and you're away that your partner was cheating on you, you want to get home, you probably want to have a conversation, and your flight's delayed and you don't get through the door till 1:48 in the morning. There's two scenarios. Does she get through the door and we see her on that CCTV, her own camera, getting home, looking exhausted, and we know she was exhausted from what Nicole was saying. Does she let herself in, crawl into bed and go straight to sleep? Or is there another alternative where she wakes him up? Is he indeed even sleeping? And then they have a conversation, a very distressing conversation. And, you know, there's those two scenarios, isn't there? There's possibly a third scenario where she does sleep and they wake up, as one of the other scenarios that Chris Watts gives, is that they then wake up early in the morning and it's then that they have the conversation. But I think it's important that we think about that timing as well as all the events leading up to the behavioral shift, the change in dynamics in the relationship, because there's very significant changes. This was not just a man that suddenly acted out of the blue, as a lot of people keep saying.
Right. No, I wasn't suggesting that. I was suggesting only that the actual plans for the murder were not at all well hatched or thought out. And I think given those scenarios that you just posed, Laura, that the chances of it happening that they woke up early and had this discussion or argument, I don't know. I don't see that as a possibility because it's so poorly planned. I don't know how he could have gotten everything together, backed up the truck, put Shanann's body in the back of the truck, gotten the girls up and into the truck, and gotten out of there by 5:17 if the incident happened at, you know, 4 or 4:30 in the morning. I think it would probably have had to have happened at 2 in the morning, and then he took about 3.5 hours to get everything done and get his butt out of there so he could, unfortunately, kill his kids and get rid of the bodies.
You know, I'm going to wake up every day and know that, like, this mom and her unborn child and these two little girls are not around anymore. And it breaks my heart. It is so, oh my God. And then I have to think about, like, the consequences of his actions and how they affect everybody else. Like, all of these, her family's impacted. My name is about to be, like, slandered for probably a while. I don't know how long it's going to take to heal, but I would not be surprised if it's going to be hard to go out in public sometimes for a couple of years. And that really hurts me. I'm just like, this is a horrible, horrible thing. Like, how dare you, you know? And people aren't going to understand that. You know, they're going to say, oh, you know, you're the woman that had an affair with this man who took out his whole family. And I take a step back and it's just like, I didn't know. Like, he's so disgusting. I'm so ashamed of him and everything. And I just,
do you know at 2:30 a.m. that morning that there was a hair product purchase in her email and that her credit card was declined? So, I mean, that's just a small piece of information there.
So she was definitely up then.
So she's awake. And if I also tell you, I did read the autopsies. Harrowing stuff, I have to say. And I wouldn't suggest that anybody seeks out those documents, because it is so harrowing when you understand the detail of what happened. But I will share with you that when Shanann was found in a shallow grave, she was found wearing a purple t-shirt, her bra and her knickers. Now, again, why that's significant to me, and I've talked to quite a lot of women about this, is how many women sleep in their bras? You know, question mark. I don't know many. I'm sure there are who do, but they're quite uncomfortable. And therefore, the fact that she was found in her bra, I doubt that he would have dressed her. So it points more to the fact that, you know, if you are feeling very upset about something and emotionally churned up, to me, you're probably far more likely, even though we know she wasn't confrontational, but to want to have that discussion with your partner when you get through the door. And the other piece of information that I learned just about Bella and Cece is that they were very light sleepers. And the reason why the truck wasn't ever parked on the driveway was primarily because it would wake the children up, him getting up early in the morning and going off in the truck. It was also because he didn't like oil going on the driveway. So that tells us a little bit about him being thoughtful, careful, perfectionist about things too. It wasn't just Shanann. But I think the fact the girls are light sleepers may indicate that an argument happened and they woke up and they walked into their parents' bedroom, and perhaps they did witness either the last part of it or some part of it, or perhaps seeing their mother just lying motionless.
Right.
And in those moments, and I would agree with you, Jim, although I suspect from Chris Watson trying to immerse into his black and white thinking world, his rigidity, I would expect that he might have the mentality of acting in those moments of this no body, no crime, of doing the worst thing. And I wonder whether it took place at the house, despite his first account saying that it happened up and he took the girls on the 45-minute car ride. Perhaps it did happen actually in the house. Now, that probably takes us no further forward, whether it happened in the house or whether it happened later on, other than if it happened later on, there's clear premeditation. He would have had at least an hour to think about not doing that to his two girls who are asleep in the back, their mother's dead body. He had time to think about doing something completely different. And so that does put him in the premeditated if it comes to the children. But I do wonder whether they were reactions in those moments because of his limited cognition and inability to see different possible scenarios, which is what got him into the situation in the first place of, well, why doesn't he just let Shanann go? But I do suspect also that if the argument took place, there's a strong likelihood that that argument, well, perhaps Shanann said, well, you're not getting the children. I'm taking the children. You're the one that cheated. And we know that 76% of domestic violence murders happen on separation. And the argument that precedes the murder is children, child custody, child contact. So there's that to consider too. It could, relatively speaking, be a plain case. And I accept the emotion and everything that goes with it. But that in those moments, when talking about separation, which is highly charged, where he has been called out for his cheating, where it is clear to her that there is evidence that he did, whereas before she was saying, I will do anything to fix this. Just tell me what you need. There's an instant shift that now she knows that he threw the marital counselling book away, that he has no intention of fixing it. And that could have been the moment, although we've got multiple events building up to this moment, where there is a charged argument and he puts his hands around her neck. But I do not believe that he had no control over that, which is what he said on his interview with Tammy Lee and the FBI agent, Graham Calder.
As soon as I heard that, I thought of what you have said so many times here on Real Crime Profile and elsewhere about once a spouse puts his hands around his controlled spouse's neck, the person that he's trying to control, the chances of lethality go up dramatically.
Sevenfold in that moment.
How would you account for him having no scratches or bruises or any indication that she fought back? I mean, do you think it was just he just overpowered her and she wasn't able to? Or
he was doing a lot of push-ups in those videos. I think he was pretty strong. And I think it's easy if she could be, you know, packing or, you know, walking away or something, he can literally just grab her around the arms from behind, throw her on the bed and just, you know.
I mean, it's a good question because, and I know lots of people have been asking it. And, you know, I suspect obviously with lupus and her having these very draining, you know, when we all put ourselves in the situation when we have these highly charged or emotional arguments that are highly unpleasant anyway, and then you add in not sleeping, not eating, we're early hours of the morning, she has lupus, you know, potentially even that in and of itself could be a reason why she doesn't fight back. It could be, as Jim said, just purely the physicality. We know he's been doing an awful lot of physical work to himself, and or it could be by surprise. It could be that she didn't see it coming. And, you know, I listened to what Sandy, her mum, said and what her dad said. You know, they're of different opinions. Sandy thought because of the lupus, that would have a serious impact. Dad thought that she would fight back. I know from the cases that I've worked that when hands are around the neck, and, you know, again, this is graphic, this is what I train law enforcement on, and I'll be training over the next few weeks when I talk about strangulation, but when hands are around the neck or someone's being asphyxiated and their air supply is being cut off, you do fight tooth and nail, unless you are incapacitated or it's by surprise. And she is physically not in a good place or space either.
Well, that's my question. He has admitted that he did slip her an oxy while he was in North Carolina with her. And so some people have wondered if he did that again, although her tox screen, I don't know, would they check for that? I don't know. Her tox screen had a little bit of alcohol in it, which the coroner said was probably a post-mortem, some kind of reaction. I mean, do you think that would be possible? And do you, I mean, his confession says he sat on top of her and strangled her face to face. Is there any reason why you don't think that that's what he did?
He also said it happened when they were having sex. He's come up with so many different variations, mm-hmm. Lisa. Quite frankly, I don't believe any of them. Mm-hmm. He has continued to lie. And I said this when it happened. That's the one thing that's consistent. He has continuously lied and given different versions of events. But it's possible that something was put into her. I mean, I think he did say that he was trying to terminate the baby and therefore he was giving her. And this all came out much later on. It's possible. And with toxicology, you have to ask for certain things to be screened.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's a possibility, but I suspect it's unlikely.
Like I said this morning, I think that based upon his Google searches, his cell phone searches, some of the things that he was doing while Shanann and the girls were in North Carolina, I think it became pretty obvious that he found a new love interest. And for whatever reason in his mind, divorce wasn't an option. I can't speak as to why anyone would take the steps that he did, but during the course of our investigation, other than the normal stressors of financial stress that I think most of us have, the occasional marital stress, we couldn't find anything else that was a significant enough motive to annihilate your family in the manner that he did. Yeah.
And in the courtroom, you talked about, again, to your point, that partial motive, that desire to start a new, fresh start. Can you describe some of the evidence that you found, some of those Google searches you were just mentioning?
There was everything from photographs of he and his girlfriend at the Great Sand Dunes in southern Colorado during the time that Shanann was in North Carolina. We knew that they had gone to other museums together. They had gone to bars and restaurants together. Like I said this morning, he had done searches dealing with secluded vacation spots in Aspen that he was planning on apparently taking her to. He was researching jewelry. He was doing all of that kind of research that you would think that somebody in a brand new relationship would be doing, but he was still married with two daughters and a son on the way.
Even if she wasn't completely ready for bed, he might have gotten her to sit down on the bed. And it's very easy to, unfortunately, wrap somebody in a sheet, you know, and pin their arms. And there's plenty of different ways that could be done. I don't know what he did. And I have not read the autopsy, so I don't know what other artifacts might have been found on her body. But all I can say is he was a strong guy. His wife was stricken with lupus. She was obviously very tired from a long day of travel and from days of not eating and sleeping right. She was probably, unfortunately, extremely vulnerable from a physical point of view, and he took advantage of that. There's no question.
Yeah, I mean, the autopsy, Jim, we know that she didn't have any defensive wounds, and that is something that is quite rare in a case like this. Like I said, unless someone's been incapacitated, but I would agree, and we do know she was wrapped in a sheet. So was she wrapped in a sheet afterwards, or was that part of preventing her from using her arms and hands and from struggling? We won't know, but in my professional experience, I tend to always go along the lines of Occam's razor, that when we're talking about behavior, normally the simplest explanation is the most likely. And you can come up with all sorts of possibilities and all sorts of scenarios, but I do think there are only really two possible scenarios here. Why he is coming up with so many other narratives, you know, subsequently, I would imagine that there's something about the attention and the limelight and all these women writing to him in prison that is something that he is quite enjoying. But he has moved from the first reason, which is what he said was to avenge the two little girls, Bella and Cece. He then moved to the devil made me do it. And then, you know, one of the later things that he said was that it was Nikki that made him do it. And at no point does he ever talk about his choices and I think the truth about how it happened and why it happened that way. But I do see an absence of guilt. And what I normally see in these cases where you have a family annihilation is the perpetrator most often tries to commit suicide, to take their own life by suicide, or to attempt it at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absent in this case. He actually did everything possible to dispose of the bodies, and saying it crudely, it was like he was just disposing of rubbish, throwing them away, and then he gets on with his everyday life with the shovel still in the car and texts his girlfriend as if it's just a normal day, saying that he's busy, tries to put the house on the market, tries to unenroll the girls in school, doesn't even report them missing, at no point tried to give them medical aid. And here's somebody now trying to control everything post to continue to have a normal
everyday life. Yeah, it just really, really leaks out how criminally unsophisticated this man was and how much he thought he was just going to be able to go on and not have to do anything and not have to address what he had just done or take responsibility for what he just did. And especially Nikki's reactions with his first set of lies that Shanann ran off with the kids, you know, just let her go, you know, good riddance, whatever. That's what you were planning on doing anyway.
I think it's interesting. I don't know if you find this interesting, but So just 2 days before the murder was when he was with a friend and happened to overhear his boss asking his friend about work that week. And he volunteers to go to the site where he ends up dumping them. He says, I'll go out there straight away on Monday morning before coming into the office, and I'll go to that way out of the way site that nobody even, it's called Survey 319 or Survey, it's the Survey Ranch. So it seems like that's where he got the idea, at least, of where he was going to dispose of them, somewhere out there. But what do you make of him, you know, half burying Shannon and then separating the girls into each oil tank? It's so hard for me to say those things. And did he know why he did that as far as how he disposed of them? Or is there something subconsciously why he separated them like that?
You know, we have no way of absolutely knowing that, but clearly what he attempted to do with Shannon was permanent concealment. It's something that guys typically do that by burying their victims. So that would be my first prediction, would be that that's what he would have done to Shannon. Adults are much more difficult to dispose of than children. I'm sorry to say it that way, but that's the truth. And typically we see a water burial, but in this case, we see a burial in other liquid, which is oil. I believe that he just felt that was more efficient and effective, and he may have felt a great deal more remorse about that, about killing his two innocent daughters. And so I think maybe that might be why you see a difference in the disposal and concealment methods.
It's something that's obviously accessible to him. You know, we have someone with, and I'm going to say it, he's not that smart. This guy is not smart, not just criminally, he's not criminally sophisticated. We know that. He's not forensically aware, but he's not very smart either. And I think most perpetrators go to what they know in situations when they're under pressure. And we talk about it in terms of anchor points, don't we, Jim, in terms of body deposition. Mm-hmm. It would normally be somewhere that somebody knows. I think the fact that they're in separate locations is much more about practicality. And I would hazard the guess that to put Shannon to try and get her up the tower, and apparently the hatch was very small, so her body wouldn't, and I'm sorry, this is really horrific to have this discussion, but it is the reality. Mm-hmm. These cases, it's not entertainment, this is the reality when somebody murders somebody and disposes of their body, and there are practicalities to consider. So I would imagine that he chose, you know, a shallow grave for Shannon. He probably thought it was much deeper than what it actually was. And then he took the two little girls up one by one, and separate towers, probably more on the practicality point of view because the hatch was small. But it certainly was horrific. I know there's some suggestion that maybe the girls weren't actually dead, that they could well have just been asphyxiated and unconscious. I can't go there psychologically in terms of even thinking about that. But what I do know, and I do want to just shout out to all the CSIs, all those who are involved in the body recovery, is that it was so traumatic. Many of them had counselling, trauma counselling afterwards, and are still deeply impacted by what they had to see and the recovery of the bodies of the three of them, of Shannon, Nico, and of Bella and Cece. And so that's why I keep saying this isn't entertainment. And I don't like it when people are disrespectful of just seeing it as that, because it has a real world impact on so many people. It's like the ripples on the pond, isn't it, Jim, with a crime and a crime scene, the community that are impacted, but also all law enforcement or anyone involved in body recovery, it stays with you forever. You can never unsee what you have seen.
Mm. Definitely.
So yes, it's a very heavy subject. And the last point just to say about that, I do think it was more down to practicality. It was also that because they had been disposed of the two children in oil, they couldn't fly their bodies home to North Carolina because they were so combustible. So it's just such a horrific thing that he did. Highly unnecessary, and I think that's why so many people struggle with it. A lot of people on our Facebook page, why didn't he just go down the divorce route? Well, that's exactly what we want to get to. We are deconstructing the case. This is a series. It is complicated on one side, but there is a lot more that we want to discuss, particularly in terms of psychopathy. And Jim and I would like to go through the psychopathy checklist. Jim brought it up in one of our previous episodes. So tune into our next episode where we're going to discuss Chris Watts and his behavior and the psychopathy checklist. And we will do an indirect personality assessment using the PCLR. So thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please take care of yourselves. Self-care is needed. Vicarious trauma is real. For now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.